Since this is the last lecture, let me just take the opportunity to thank everyone again, to thank Oxford Philosophy for inviting me. Thank you all for coming, and many of you for coming again and again. It's really gratifying to have this expression of interest, and the questions have given me a lot to think about, though in the moment it's very hard to keep track and remember what they are. They'll come back slowly. As Ursula just said, this is the last lecture. Tomorrow there's no agenda, no new PowerPoints. Having thanked you for giving so generously of your time already, I still hope many of you will come to explore whatever you want to explore connected to these lectures, to push back a little harder maybe on some of my ideas, but also develop new ones or just figure things out. You were invited to submit questions in advance. Only one has been submitted at this time, a good one, but it won't keep it. And at the end of these lectures, I'll put up my email again, so if anything occurs to you that it would be useful for me to think about in advance, let me encourage you to send it to me in advance. But if not, that's fine, too. I mean, it's really just meant to be an open discussion. So with that, we'll begin. Oh, it says lecture 4, and it's lecture 5. Sorry. For centuries, people both within and without the academic philosophical community have worried about the problem of freedom and determinism. A common form of the problem is expressed in the thought that if determinism is true, then with respect to anything we do, we lack the ability to do or have done otherwise. And if we lack the ability to do otherwise, the worry continues, then it is wrong or unfair or inappropriate to hold us responsible for what we actually do. The thought is that if determinism is true, then we can't help but do what we actually do, or to put it another way, then we are not in ultimate control of what we do. And so it seems we are never really responsible for anything. The claim seems especially strong and intuitive when we're thinking of bad actions or consequences, where the question of whether we are responsible is identified with the question of whether we are deserving of blame or punishment. And yet, among the individuals that we tend to hold responsible for harms are corporations, nations, and other organizations. We blame Boeing for launching a plane that has a defective maneuvering system. We blame DuPont for dumping toxic chemicals into the water. We blame our governments for surveilling us without our consent. And it seems absurd in these cases to think that if determinism is true, our blame ought to be withdrawn. In determining whether and how much to hold the relevant organization accountable, it is relevant to us whether that organization knew or was in a position to know what it was doing. Whether, for example, Boeing was aware that the system sometimes malfunctioned, or DuPont knew that the chemicals it was dumping were unsafe. It is relevant that if the organization had chosen to incur the costs of, say, further equipment testing or of building a leak-proof silo for its toxic waste, it could have done so. But it is not relevant that, for all we know, determinism is true, and that therefore it may have been metaphysically determined that the organization would not so choose. Though there is then some sense in which organizations must have the ability to do otherwise in order to be appropriately and fairly held responsible for the damages it causes, it is not a sense that is threatened by the truth of determinism. If an organization's responsibility for its actions is not threatened by determinism, however, and this is something that everyone acknowledges, why has it seemed to so many people over so many years that a person's responsibility for her actions is threatened by determinism? An answer which many people will be inclined to give is that it is because when we ask whether a person is responsible for her actions, we are thinking about responsibility in a different sense. But in what sense? A few philosophers, following Gary Watson, have distinguished between two kinds or senses of responsibility, which Watson labeled accountability and attributability. To hold someone responsible in the accountability sense is to expect her to meet certain standards or abide by certain norms in such a way that, should she fail to meet those standards, it is regarded as appropriate to blame her, to administer certain sanctions, or to harbor certain reactive attitudes, such as resentment or anger or indignation toward her. To regard someone as responsible for something in the attributability sense, in a version of this concept that I would support, is rather to see the individual as a self like us, a being with a point of view or sensibility or take on the world that has been formed and is continually open to revision by the individual's faculties of perception, imagination, reasoning, reflection, and so on, and to see the object of attribution as an expression of the individual's self. In the first part of this lecture, I shall argue that the answer to the question, why does determinism seem to threaten the responsibility of human beings but not the responsibility of organizations, has to do with the fact that while the responsibility at issue in the case of organizations is merely accountability responsibility, the responsibility of interest in the case of human beings concerns attributability as well. But judging from the way the issue has been discussed in the past, that is not the answer that most people who are concerned about responsibility and determinism are likely to give. Nor, indeed, is it anywhere in the neighborhood of their customary answers. On the contrary, most people who worry about responsibility and determinism are worried precisely about accountability, about the appropriateness or fairness of blaming or sanctioning someone who behaves badly or wrongly on the hypothesis that everything is determined. And they worry about this despite the fact that the worry does not seem to extend to the accountability of organizations. To explain this, they are apt to suggest that there are two kinds of accountability. We may call them shallow accountability and deep. The accountability of organizations, they might say, is a thin and shallow thing, justified pragmatically for the benefit of society as a way of deterring organizations from hurting the community and of recovering costs when damage is done. But the kind of accountability we are concerned with respect to humans is different. If it is justified, it will license an angrier, more pointed kind of blame, a kind it would be more hurtful for a person to receive, perhaps, than the kind we direct towards organizations, whose appropriateness would not depend on the usefulness of the practice of accountability and sanction. If a person acts badly in some relevant way, the blame would be simply, non-pragmatically, deserved. And it is this kind of accountability that seems threatened by determinism, and indeed, as some go on to say, by indeterminism as well. This, I submit, is the way philosophers and philosophically minded people have thought about the problem of responsibility for generations. But while I grant that the character of holding people accountable for bad behavior is often different from the character of holding organizations accountable, I think the idea that this reflects two kinds of accountability is mistaken. Rather, I believe that there is just one kind of accountability, but its significance varies according to the type of agent whose accountability is in question, as well as with the explanatory reasons behind the agent's behaving as she does. To persuade you, I want to consider a kind of case of human accountability that tends to get little attention. Typically, when we think of holding someone accountable, we focus on cases where the person's behavior expresses her values or character. She lies to you or steals from you or pushes you aside, perhaps, because she just doesn't care or doesn't care enough about your interests as compared to hers. You're inclined to be resentful, full of blame, and you want her to feel your anger. But thinking about determinism gives you pause and makes you wonder whether these feelings and attitudes are appropriate or fair. But now consider a case in which the person's bad behavior is not an expression of bad values or character. She has just the values and the character you would want her to have. Still, mistakes happen. Even good people screw up sometimes. One forgets to lock the gate, or to pick up a carton of milk, or to call one's mother on her birthday. One spills red wine on one's friend's new shirt, or leaves home too late to make one's appointment on time, or uses the wrong pronoun. Often, what happens in cases like this is that the victim gets angry and voices annoyance, calling the misstep to the agent's attention, and the agent quickly expresses regret, apologizing, resolving to do better next time, and trying to make it up to the person she neglected or harmed. And then, at least in cases where the harm is not great and the victim can be compensated, the people move on. Case closed. What are we to say about the victim's initial reaction or about the agent's accountability for the offenses in these cases? Was it wrong for the victim to blame the agent for showing up late or ruining her shirt? Was the agent not accountable for being punctual or careful with her drink? I don't see anything wrong in the sort of exchange I've described. Getting angry or annoyed, blaming, seems a perfectly appropriate response to inconvenience or harm. Regret, apology, and a desire to make it up to the person one has harmed or offended seems a perfectly appropriate response to the recognition that one has messed up. Were the victim to keep blaming after the apology and penance, that would be excessive. But this is not because the agent wasn't blameworthy, but just that the blame had been voiced and addressed. People are accountable, after all, for arriving at their appointments on time, running errands they have agreed to, and so on. And it is perfectly natural to get mad, maybe just a little mad, when something one was counting on someone to do doesn't get done. I needed that milk for tonight's dinner. This was my favorite shirt. Such outbursts and scoldings are among the sanctions one expects when one violates these sorts of norms. That is why, in the cases I'm discussing, the violators respond as they do. In some ways, these exchanges seem similar to the cases of corporate responsibility I've referred to. One party violates a norm, the victim calls the violator to account, issuing an appropriately proportional and recognized sanction. The perpetrator accepts the sanction, paying the penalty, apologizing, and cleaning up its act. Or, in the case of DuPont, its waterways. And everyone moves on. Moreover, in such cases, the idea that metaphysical determinism might undermine the appropriateness of such exchanges seems absurd. Not just in the corporate cases, but in the personal ones too. Surely the truth of determinism doesn't mean that I should stop expecting people to show up on time for their meetings. If there are two kinds of accountability, shallow and deep, this would suggest that the kind we're discussing is shallow. But this can't be right, because as soon as we turn to the more commonly considered cases in which the same kinds of misbehavior are expressions of objectionable values and characters, the worries about determinism rise up again. If there are two kinds of accountability, it can't be the case that which kind turns out to be at issue switches depending on the reasons a particular agent follows or violates a norm. It can't be that when a decent person whose values and characters are fine shows up late for an appointment, she is only shallowly accountable, but when a selfish or lazy person keeps us waiting, she is either deeply accountable or not at all. So I suggest that there is only one kind of accountability, and that if determinism threatens our attitudes towards human misbehavior in a way that it does not threaten our attitudes to organizational wrongdoing, the problem must lie somewhere else. The problem arises specifically in the cases in which an individual's behavior is seen as an expression of the individual's self, or more precisely, of her character or values, and in which, due to its being seen this way, we are inclined to have certain attitudes towards her, anger, resentment, indignation perhaps, and to want to blame and sanction her in a particularly pointed way. The problem thus seems connected to what I earlier called the attributability of the act to the agent. The truth of determinism seems either to call into question the idea that the act really is attributable to the agent, or, well, that is, that the action really is an expression of the agent's self, or to undermine the idea that there can be the right kinds of cells at all, cells rich enough or deep enough to warrant the kinds of reactive attitudes that we are pre-reflectively inclined to feel towards adult human beings, but not toward young children or psychopaths or corporations. I shall argue that the latter concern is the more coherent or more appropriate one to have. But I believe that the nature of that concern is usually misunderstood, and so, following this argument, I shall explain what I take the concern ultimately to amount to. How might the thought of determinism lead to either of these worries? Are either of them warranted? To explore these questions, it will be helpful to have a couple concrete examples before us. So, for one example, imagine a friend who lies to you about why she, quote unquote, can't come to your birthday party, saying that she's ill when really she just isn't in the mood. For the second example, we can consider a more serious, if less personal, case. Let it be the very DuPont executive who, after calculating how much it would cost the company to build an adequate protective silo for its chemical waste, issued the order to dump it in the water, betting that the company wouldn't get caught. We have already established that determinism doesn't undermine the thought that the agents could have acted differently in such a way as to deprive them of accountability completely. It's not as if your friend had to lie, whether she wanted to or not, or that the DuPont executive's hand was being guided by an unseen force in dictating that the waste be dumped in the river and the research about its probable health effects be suppressed. That is why, in the cases of agents whose characters and values were unobjectionable, but who had just messed up, spilling their drinks, being late to their meetings, whatever, there was nothing problematic about holding the individuals in question accountable. But in the cases that we are now considering, our attitudes towards the agents are stronger and our judgments about them more negative. It's not just that what they did that upsets us, but what their actions expressed about them. For these stronger attitudes and judgments and the harsher sanctions which they make us want to apply to their subjects to be justified, it seems something more than the ability to do otherwise that is compatible with determinism is required. What? The answer, it seems, must be something in the neighborhood of the ability to know better or to be better. The ability to see why their behavior was bad or wrong and to appreciate it in such a way as to lead to their acting otherwise. Your friend, knowing how much it meant to you to have her at your party, should have known that she should have just sucked it up and come to the party even if she didn't want to. Or at least that she shouldn't have lied to you, pretending that illness had kept her away. And of course, the DuPont executive should have known that the risk to human health and safety takes priority over company profits and of its effect on the arc of her professional career. But the thought that these people should have known better presupposes that they could have known better, that they had, in other words, the abilities necessary to know better than they did. We didn't feel the need for these abilities in those other cases in which people of good character just screwed up. They did know better, they acknowledged as much, and they went on to apologize and compensate insofar as they could. In these cases, we do need these abilities, and the question is determinism compatible with them? Let us think for a minute about what we usually mean when we say that a person is able to know better than they do know, or to be better than they are. One might consult one's own history. Haven't we all done things of which we say later, I should have known better than to do them? On what basis did we make those claims? And haven't we all on occasion become better, at least in small and minor ways? What abilities were needed to bring that about? It seems to me that when I say I should have known better, what I have in mind is that I had all the information and experience, all the data, so to speak, that I needed, as well as the training and faculties of reason, reflection, imagination, and so on, to apply to the data to reach the right conclusion. I had all that it should take, in other words, to arrive at the knowledge or the appreciation or the understanding of that knowledge that I must X and not Y, the knowledge that I must X and not Y, even though I failed actually to arrive at this knowledge at the time. So for it to be true of the DuPont executive that she should have and could have known better, what is required is that she have all the information and experience, all the training, all the faculties necessary for her to reach the conclusion that she must not put thousands of innocent people at risk in order to save corporate costs. Is it compatible with determinism that she have these things? From one perspective, it seems reasonable to reply, of course it is, why wouldn't it be? Presumably, everyone in this room knows that it is wrong to throw toxic waste in the river for the sake of corporate profit. And although it is not obvious precisely what experience and what faculties of thought are needed for us to have come to this knowledge, from the fact that we all have this knowledge, we can infer that we have the requisite experience and abilities to have it. Such experience and abilities are hardly exceptional. If we have these abilities, why wouldn't the DuPont executive? Barring any special extenuating circumstances, then, it seems reasonable to assume that in the ordinary sense in which we sometimes could have and should have known better than to do some of the things that we do, the DuPont executive could have and should have known better than to approve the dumping of toxic waste in the river. And your friend could have and should have known better than to lie to you about your party. And it is usually with this ordinary sense of could have and should have that we are concerned when we wonder whether it is appropriate to attribute someone's failure to know better or to be better than they are to them. In other words, just as the ability to do otherwise that is necessary for accountability seems compatible with determinism, the abilities to know otherwise or to have other values or to be a better person that are necessary for attributability seems compatible with determinism as well. And yet, when one focuses on the fact that if determinism is true, every thought and every impulse we have, as well as every thought and impulse that we fail to have, is determined, it is hard to hold on to that perspective. There is at least an apparent tension between determinism and the thought that a person could have known better or been better in whatever sense is necessary for responsibility. If determinism is true, a person might say, then even though someone has all the intelligence and the experience that would be needed to come to the right conclusion, the fact that she did not reach that conclusion, that she didn't know better or develop the right values or become a right person, was not up to her. Alternatively, they might say it was not her fault or that she couldn't help it. With others, I find it tempting to make these remarks, and I think there is a grain of truth in them. But I also believe that they're highly misleading with respect to their implications for a person's responsibility. The grain of truth consists in the fact that, at least in most instances, the fact that a person fails to know what we think she ought to know, or that she fails to be what she thinks she ought to be, what we think she ought to be, or fails to value what we think she ought to value, is not under her voluntary control. One cannot make oneself understand something or acquire a virtue by an act of will. The DuPont executive who failed to appreciate the priority of human safety over corporate profit could not, by an act of will, have made herself appreciate it. If she was callous, as we are assuming she was, it was not because she chose to be callous, nor could she stop being callous all at once simply by deciding to change. But while these remarks give us reasons not to hold the executive accountable for her moral ignorance or her moral character, they do not imply that her ignorance, her character, or her choosing to order the toxic waste to be dumped are not attributable to her. In the vocabulary I introduced last week, we could say that although she may not be blameworthy for her character, she may still be criticizable for it. For an act or state of affairs or character trait to be attributable to an individual, remember, is for that act, state of affairs, character trait, or whatever, to express the individual's self. And at least for all that has been said so far, they do express herself. She is, by stipulation, a callous, greedy person. It's an expression of her callousness that seeing how much it would cost to find some other way of disposing the company's toxic waste, she, wrongly as we know, concluded that it should just dump the waste in the river. Both her decision and her action then express her callousness, and her callousness is an expression or a part of her take on the world. Insofar as we express the thought that she was determined to be callous with the words, "so it's not her fault that she is callous," or "so it's not up to her," we implicitly, I think, convert or restrict the question of the executive's responsibility into the question of her accountability for her character. In so doing, we unwittingly, or perhaps wittingly, shift from our initial concern about whether it is appropriate and fair to blame and punish her for ordering the dumping of the toxic waste to the question of whether it is appropriate and fair to blame and punish her for being callous. But this is a mistake. Though it is an interesting and difficult question to what extent an individual is accountable for her character, it's not a question that needs to be answered when wondering whether she is accountable for an action, even an action that expresses her character. Nor does that question need to be answered to determine what more specific attitudes, judgments, and sanctions are appropriate to apply to her on the assumption that she is accountable. What we need to know is not whether she was accountable for her character, but whether she, the individual who is accountable for the violation, really has a character, and if so, what character it is that is expressed in her action. Or to put it another way, we need to know whether she is a being with sufficient powers of active intelligence to be a self like us, to whom character traits and the behaviors they express can be attributable. Being a self and having a character at all opens her up, as it were, to the range of reactive feelings and associated judgments and responses we have towards deeply responsible beings. Which feelings and other responses we have are a function of the particular character and values that we take to be expressed in her behavior, in virtue of which the behavior has the meaning and significance for us that it does. For those who are still skeptical or confused about the distinction between accountability and attributability, let me try to make these points in another way, focusing this time on the less serious but more personal case of the friend who lies to you about why she did not come to your party. When you first learned of the lie, we can assume you were hurt and angry. By choosing to stay home, your friend acted selfishly, and it was cowardly of her to make up an excuse. But the thought that her values and character are determined might lead to the thought that her selfishness and cowardice are not her fault, or alternatively, to the thought that her values and character are not ultimately up to her. Once again, these thoughts may in part be a way to register that these traits and values are not in the immediate or complete control of your friend's will. But insofar as they suggest that there is a conceivable, possible world in which a person's character and values are in the control of her will, and in which people's status as responsible agents would therefore be less problematic, these thoughts are misleading. When one says or thinks it's not her fault that she's selfish, this might suggest that her selfishness has been implanted in or forced upon her. But this is not the way character acquisition typically works, and if it ever works this way, that is not a consequence of determinism. When one says or thinks her cowardice is not up to her, this might suggest that there is a her or a self beneath or beside her character that's being sidelined or ignored. But there is no self deeper than or separate from the cowardly person, your friend, herself. This is not to say that herself just is her character, a set of stable dispositions and values that in any given situation will react with a predictable response. A self is an individual existing in time. In addition to having or being a set of dispositions, values, and beliefs, she has or is a set of faculties, including perceptual faculties, rationality, imagination, and empathy, which together constitute an active intelligence with which her beliefs, values, and character interact. Assuming that your friend is a normal human being, the character she has at the time she makes up an excuse is itself partly a consequence of her exercise of these faculties. So is her reaction to the hurt and anger you feel, if you let her know about them, after her dissemblance to you is brought to light. The fact that our characters and our values are not in the direct or complete control of our will is a fact of life, totally independent of the truth or falsity of determinism. And, at least when one is not in the grip of a train of thought set in motion by a philosophical worry about determinism and responsibility, it is hard to see why anyone would mind this or find it threatening. For a variety of reasons, I believe, when we reflect on the significance of determinism for responsibility and the appropriateness of the reactive attitudes, we are led along trains of thought that make us think we need powers that we don't really need and freedoms that would not actually be valuable. We overrate the importance of voluntary control. We abstract from the quality and importance of our not wholly voluntary intelligence. And we fail to appreciate the significance of the fact that both ourselves and our reactions to other selves develop, occur, and change over time. And yet, I do think there is something profoundly unsettling about the thought that every aspect of us might be determined. So far, I've been exploring a way a concern about freedom and determinism presents itself that accepts, or appears to accept, that if we put metaphysics to one side, we are more or less what we think we are, people with character and values, virtues and vices, that manifest themselves in the way we behave and whom we are inclined to react to with blame and praise, criticism and admiration, resentment, indignation, gratitude, and love. These things, we might be tempted to say, paraphrasing Strawson in Freedom and Resentment, are among the facts as we know them. They are not up for dispute. The consideration that everything about us is determined is not thought to threaten the accuracy of these descriptions, but rather to undermine the appropriateness of or justifications for our reactive attitudes and other responses. If we are determined to be the way we are, if our existence and behavior are just episodes in a chain of events stretching from before our births into a future beyond our deaths, the worry is that we are not appropriate stopping points upon which to direct our judgments and attitudes, at least not the sorts of judgments and attitudes in question. Thus, in the examples on which I've been focusing, the DuPont executive is acknowledged to be callous and the friend to be selfish and cowardly, but the thought that their vices and their consequent decisions are products of forces beyond their control makes us wonder whether it is fair to blame them for any of this. The incompatibles concerns that I've been addressing worry that determinism undermines or breaks the natural intuitive connection between noticing that a person has a certain character trait, callousness or cowardice, for example, and harboring strong reactive attitudes towards her because of that. My remarks today, invoking the contrast between accountability and attributability, are intended to persuade you that this train of thought is misguided. But there is another way the thought of determinism might seem to undermine the appropriateness of our reactions, namely by questioning whether it is right to think of these people as having these character traits or even characters at all. I do not mean to deny that they have psychological dispositions that manifest themselves in their behavior. The DuPont executive is evidently disposed to assign little weight to considerations of the welfare of strangers in her practical decision-making. The dissembling friend is disposed to avoid uncomfortable confrontations, even at the cost of violating moral norms. Some people think of character as consisting of nothing more than a collection of such dispositions, which a given individual exhibits stably over some considerable period of time. But in order to make sense of the appropriateness or inappropriateness of our reactive attitudes to people, it's important to distinguish this shallow use of character from a more robust sense of the term. Compare our reactions to ordinary people with our reactions to other individuals, such as sociopaths, corporations, and non-human animals who behave in superficially similar ways. Our reaction to crocodiles, for example, who will kill you at any opportunity, are very different from our reactions to trigger-happy outlaws, hitmen, and assassins. We protect ourselves from crocodiles. We try to avoid getting physically close to them. But we do not get angry at them or criticize them for being the way they are. As an elaboration of this point, we may say that although crocodiles are notably and thoroughly indifferent to human life, they cannot be callously indifferent. I trust that everyone will agree about this, but the question is, why can't crocodile indifference be callous? I believe that the difference has to do with the difference between human, at least normal adult human intelligence, and crocodile intelligence, with the fact that while normal adult human beings are susceptible to reasons to care about human welfare, crocodiles are not. For callousness is a thick concept referring to a vice. To be callous is to be not just indifferent to human welfare, but objectionably so. And it is only objectionable to be indifferent to human welfare, as opposed to merely bad for us, in a context of susceptibility to reasons not to be indifferent. Callousness, in other words, is only possible in individuals who are capable of seeing, understanding, and appreciating reasons not to be callous. It does not matter for my purposes today whether you think that the judgment that one should be indifferent to human welfare is an objective or universal moral truth, nor that you agree with me in using the term callousness in quite the way I do. What matters is that we agree that people in our present community, one that includes, for example, DuPont executives, ought to care about human welfare, that they are capable of understanding and appreciating the reasons why they ought to care, and so, if they don't care, their indifference constitutes a vice. Crocodiles, incapable as they are of understanding and appreciating such reasons, or indeed, I would say, of having such reasons, are not a part of this community, nor are they candidates for vice. Related to this, and perhaps more to the point, is the fact that when a crocodile exhibits indifference to us, it does not constitute an insult or an affront. This is why we do not get outraged or angry at the crocodile. We just try to protect ourselves from him. The worry about determinism that I've been considering up till now was formulated in terms that took for granted that people had characters with various virtues and vices, and asked whether, in light of determinism, it was fair or appropriate to harbor strong reactive attitudes towards people on the basis of the characters they possess. But if the attributions of character depend on a context of susceptibility to reasons for and against that character, or more precisely, for and against the thoughts, desires, and values that the relevant character embodies, it can seem puzzling how, if determinism is true, having a character in this robust sense is even possible. For an individual's every thought, every feeling, every recognition of a reason, and so also every moment when she fails to recognize a reason, is determined. If that's true, in what sense is the individual susceptible to reasons that she does not have or see? What can we mean when we say that an individual is susceptible to reasons she doesn't actually have? That, for example, she could have known better than to think that dumping toxic waste in the river was an okay thing to do, or that she could have known better than to stay home from your party and lie to you about it. We do not and should not require that she have been able to make herself know better by an effort of will, but mustn't it at least be metaphysically possible that she know better in a way that conflicts with determinism? When we criticize a person for not knowing or caring about something we think they should know or care about, we do so against the background assumption that they could know or care about that thing. But what does that could amount to in the context of determinism? As I said earlier, when we reflect on the occasions when we think to ourselves, I should have known better, we seem to mean by that we have both the intelligent faculties and the requisite evidence that would have been necessary for us to come to know it, and there were no overwhelmingly large obstructions to our exercising these faculties in conjunction with our evidence to reach the right conclusion. But there's something unsatisfying, at least something I find unsatisfying, about this answer when one places it in the context of the thought of determinism. For when one exercises one's intelligent faculties to come to a conclusion, one actively goes through a process that takes one from one mental state to another in accordance with and because one sees the conclusion is warranted. Such a process requires a kind of openness of mind. Were we restricting ourselves exclusively to the exercise of rationality, we might call it an openness to going wherever the arguments take us. And although I know of no argument to establish that such a process and such an openness is incompatible with metaphysical determinism, I confess that the thought of determinism makes the question of whether and how such a process is possible especially salient. The problem comes up especially when we're considering cases of epistemic, characterological, and behavioral failure, when we're thinking of someone about whom we are inclined to say she could have and should have done or known or been otherwise and better. The thought that she was determined suggests, even though it does not prove, that she could not have done better, that she just is what she is, and one has simply to deal with it, much as one deals with the crocodile. But if I'm right in identifying the root of the problem with a puzzle about the individual's susceptibility to reasons, then whatever doubts or puzzles we have about the appropriateness of the reactive attitudes towards the vicious or bad-acting agent apply just as much to the appropriateness of reactive attitudes towards agents whom we are inclined to think are thinking, valuing, and acting well. For the basis for doubt, if my analysis is right, is nothing more nor less than the difficulty of understanding how it is possible to think. Understanding thinking to be not just the conscious experience of one damn thought after another, but the exercise of faculties of intelligence that allow us to correct our mistakes, reduce errors, and gain understanding, appreciation, and insight. Crocodiles can do none of these things, and that is why it makes no sense to resent them when they manifest indifference to our welfare. But for similar reasons, it would make no sense to love or feel grateful to a creature with the brain power of a crocodile that was hardwired to attend to and foster our interests. It's open to someone who is sympathetic to my puzzlement about how thinking in this robust sense is possible to observe that, although I have presented the puzzle as especially salient in the context of assuming the truth of determinism, the problem should strike us as equally puzzling when we assume the truth of indeterminism. Alternatively, one might suggest that it is not determinism versus indeterminism at all, but mechanism that seems to pose a threat to our capacity for intelligent thought. I'm inclined to agree with both these remarks, to think, in other words, that the puzzle about whether and if so how intelligent thought is possible might come not from any particular metaphysical hypothesis, but from metaphysical thinking quite generally. Perhaps, that is, the problem will arise with any attempt to integrate a detached view of ourselves in the world with the point of view one occupies as a participant in the world, as one thinking intelligent agent among others. But this does not make the problem of finding an adequate justification for our reactive attitudes or for other manifestations of our taking ourselves to be deeply responsible any better. I began this lecture asking what it is about the hypothesis of determinism that seems so philosophically threatening to responsibility. In leading you through the series of reflections I have, my point has been to relocate the crux of the problem from what it has customarily been taken to be. I've been arguing that the problem is not that responsibility requires a contra-causal ability to exercise one's will free of the influence of physical and psychological laws, nor is it a problem about ourselves, our psyches, and our decisions being a product of a history that began before our births and was a fortiori outside of our control. The problem, I have been suggesting, is rather a problem about whether and how we can be what we think we are, intelligent beings with the capacity to understand and appreciate the world around us, who express ourselves, our values, desires, hopes, attitudes, and so on, in what we say and do. If the problem is not restricted to the context of determinism, but arises on any conceivable metaphysical hypothesis, so much the worse. Or perhaps so much the better. For if I'm right that at the bottom of the worries that are sparked when we think about freedom, responsibility, and determinism is a puzzle about how it is possible truly to think, then it seems we are assured of being able to answer these worries, at least in one sense. That is, however puzzled we may be about how intelligent thought is possible, we cannot really doubt that it is possible. There are, in fact, two sorts of arguments for this. The first, somewhat in the spirit of G.E. Moore's argument against skepticism, here is one hand and here is another, is by reminding ourselves that we are thinking at this very moment. Or to take a somewhat longer route, let's review how we got to the worry about the possibility of intelligent thought in the first place. It was, you'll remember, the end of a train of thought focused on an individual who acted in a way we condemned, whose action was, at least so it seemed, an expression of her character, of her values, and of the way she saw the world. Our inclination to blame her, to be indignant and so on, reflected the fact that we saw her action as an expression of an objectionable callousness or selfishness or some other vice, which we thought she should have known better and done better than to have. But the thought of determinism pulled us up short, making it puzzling whether she really could have known better. For if she was determined to have the thoughts, feelings, imaginings, and reflections she did have, it is not clear that she was susceptible to having different reasons, the reasons that would have made her less callous and that would have led her to choosing a different action. But then I pointed out that if it were really true that she couldn't have known better, in whatever sense of could should matter to us, then it is somewhat misleading to regard her as objectionably callous rather than just more neutrally indifferent. In the same way, though perhaps to a less extreme degree or with a more limited scope, as crocodiles are indifferent. But if one follows the train of thought this far and comes to see the implications of determinism or indeterminism or mechanism as undermining the apparently callous person's capacity to so much as be callous, one should extend one's skepticism to the kind and sympathetic person, the honest person, the good friend as well. If metaphysics undermines the vicious person's capacity to know and to be better in virtue of undermining her capacity for intelligent thought, then it undermines the capacity for intelligent thought in all of us, including those of us who pre-reflectively appear to be virtuous and to get things right. But surely such skepticism goes too far. For we do sometimes understand things, appreciate things, have insights, don't we? Consider such remarks as Machiavelli understands power. Henry James understands women. Otto Lange understands vegetables. Donald Bradman understands cricket. Aren't at least some of these statements or others like them true? If so, then we can say, again, paraphrasing Strawson, that the existence of intelligent human thought is among the facts as we know them. We may not yet understand how such a thing is possible, but that it is possible is self-evident, and so we can be sure that it is compatible with any metaphysics that has a chance of being true. I expect that most people will find this argument convincing, but if you are one of the holdouts, there is, as I mentioned, a second line of argument against this sort of skepticism as well. Rather than aiming to establish the existence of our capacity for intelligent thought, the second argument simply points out that we are incapable of doubting its existence. As the first argument parallels Moore's proof of the external world, this one seems closely related to Descartes' cogito, and perhaps even more to Kant's claim that we cannot act except under the idea of freedom. The point, obviously, is that it is self-contradictory to think that one is incapable of thought. One cannot coherently find it reasonable to conclude that one cannot find anything reasonable. Our own capacities for intelligent thought, in other words, set the limits of what we can mean by intelligent thought. So once again, we reach the conclusion that even if it is metaphysically puzzling how intelligent thought is possible, we cannot and should not doubt that it is possible. There's another way to put this point that connects it with the idea of what it is to be a self like us that I've been urging us to develop and adopt in the past 4 lectures. In particular, I identified being a self like us with having a point of view or sensibility or take on the world that has been formed and is continually open to revision by one's faculties of perception, imagination, reflection, reasoning, and so on. My suggestion today has been that if determinism threatens anything at all, it threatens our capacity for intelligent thought. To be skeptical about our capacity for intelligent thought, however, is essentially to be skeptical about the existence of selves like us. But, if you'll pardon the expression, we are us. And so, a fortiori, we are selves like us. Since determinism does not and cannot threaten our existence, this implies that, if my argument is right, determinism does not threaten anything at all. This is not to say that it poses no philosophical problems, just that it poses no threats.